Thank you very much for such a wonderful welcome and a lovely introduction, Elizabeth. This is the third, it seems a little strange. I feel like I'm in the fragmentation. And looking right down the middle, it's space, spaciousness. Maybe there's a reason for that. This is the third time I've had the pleasure and honor of addressing this community of Word and Life. And I just want to say something about it. 2.5 years ago, I was invited by Martha Siegel to speak on Richard Rohr. It was Christ of the Celts by John Philip Newell. And that was my first introduction and was just really engaging again with the Santa Barbara community through the tea fire. And my family, my parents still being here. A year ago, we explored Richard Rohr's book, Falling Upwards. And then I had just been hired as the new coordinating director at the Center for Spiritual Renewal at La Casa de Maria. I didn't know what I had gotten myself into. It's been a wonderful year, and I feel so blessed and lucky to be there on those grounds and working with all of the many, many individual and couple retreatants who come to that place for renewal. And here I am now a year later, and my husband and I have moved to Santa Barbara. My youngest daughter and her husband have moved here. And it is as if so many things that came out of the trauma of that fire have brought gifts untold and threads of my life coming together, as Elizabeth alluded. And it is a coming home, a coming home, a coming home on so many levels. The Word and Life community also, because I encounter a lot of different people, I meet people who've been touched by what you have been doing over the years. And you are truly offering a special gift to the Santa Barbara community through the depth of exploration, the authors you're reading, the way in which you are opening up the chapters to not only explore the gifts of these wonderful writers and thinkers, but also bringing forth those who are the wisdom carriers within this community. It is remarkable as I go back and look at all of the lectures that are available online, and each one is a gem. So I just want to thank you. Thank you for doing this work, for continuing Word and Life, and it certainly has touched many, and me. Along those lines of wisdom keepers, in the audience are two women that I'd like to recognize and honor. The first being my mother, June Christensen. And June has been a teacher here in Santa Barbara, first through dance at the Santa Barbara High School, doing many choreographed shows for youth theater. Helped, was one of the forces that brought modern dance to Santa Barbara some 60 years ago. Believe it or not, so many gifts this woman has offered, not only as my mother, but as a teacher. And her best friend is sitting next to her, Patricia McClure, who many of you had the gift of hearing last week. And I just want to welcome the two together. If you knew what these two were up to in the 80s, you'd just have your jaws drop. Unfortunately, they didn't have a Word and Life community fully grasp what they were doing. They actually started something called the Human Curriculum. And it was an exploration, really with the primary focus of education and teachers and training teachers. But it was at its heart exploring not what we learn, but how we learn. And through the books they were reading, the people they were studying, the methodologies that they were incorporating in the human curriculum, they came to many of the things that we're exploring today as to this embodied wisdom of the spirit and knowledge that lies within us each. And if but for the right environment, the right loving calling forth of that deeper gift we each carry, we would know through our education system this connection to the divine wisdom, the divine knowledge, the cosmic knowing that lives within us each. The seated, what, as I wrote it here, how we are coded from within and seated with the knowledge of the universe. They are two women who've really understood that in themselves and in working with others and working with other within systems to help draw that forth. Anyway, it's so wonderful you're here, my two teachers. So I want to start with an opening prayer. At one point, someone said they were going to sing, but I'm not sure. Maybe we'll do that later when we can are sure of the words. One of John Philip Newell's prayers, which some of you may already be well familiar with. I watch this morning for the light that the darkness has not overcome. I watch for the fire that was in the beginning, and that burns still in the brilliance of the rising sun. I watch for the glow of life that gleams in the growing earth and glistens in sea and sky. I watch for your light, O God, in the eyes of every living creature and in the ever-living flame of my own soul. If the grace of seeing were mine today, I would glimpse you in all these lives. Grant me the grace of seeing this day. Grant me the grace of seeing. The topic of Chapter 6, A Balm for All Wounds, is what we're going to explore today. And I would like to do it in two parts. There's the clock over there. We will break at 11. And in this first section, I would like to tell a few stories that relate to integration and coming to that place of healing that brings the divides together, that which has been fragmented together. And in the second part, I'd like to address five particular practices that we can do that engage very tangible things that open up this possibility of discovering, utilizing, and imparting a balm for all wounds. As Elizabeth had said, I know Philip Newell. I don't know him personally well, but I know his work well. And I know the work that he and Allie did on the Isle of Iona as co-wardens of the Iona community at the Iona Abbey. They are remarkable people, and you've already had a taste of him. How many of you went to the weekend workshop as well, so I can get an idea? A few. Okay. And how many heard him speak here? You all did. Okay. A Balm for All Wounds, and this chapter, and how he writes about it, very close to my own heart. So many of the elements and themes that he talks about in this book run parallel to threads that I've explored. From the tie to Iona and the uncovering of the Celtic worldview, the view of Christ, of original blessing, of God in creation, to his approach to dreams, to the relationship between the personal and collective experience tied into our own intimate experience. As he put it in Jung's description, the wedding of moon-like and sun-like consciousness. To the subject of holiopesis, the act of creating wholeness or of wholeness making. And that is the work of healing, the ultimate work of healing, wholeness making, that Jung so beautifully describes as that alchemical process of where you bring the divided parts together and there in discover not only the remnants of the original oneness, but of a new and greater connection and wholeness. And right down to the digging out of God in suffering, in the midst of suffering. John Philip used the journals and story of Ellie and brought them up again in this chapter, quite poignantly, quoting her and using her words as an exemplar of where and how we discover that God within the midst of suffering, and how we take a stance to become ourselves that balm. Not an expectation that it will come from without, but a commitment to being that in our own lives, whatever circumstances we are in. And as Philip, in his talk to you so passionately, at least it came across that way audibly, because I was unable to be here to hear him personally, but where our faith, and it's not just our Christian faith, but many faiths have failed us, is in that disconnect between God and God in us. Healing from a transcendent source to that healing needing to move through us. As somewhere in the book, and I don't have the exact quote, but that interpretation that we quote all the time, not thy will, not my will, God, but thine. And he states in here, I don't believe it was Meister Eckhart, but someone spoke, the will be mine. The will is mine. The unifying of those two, not separating them. Anyway, in John Philip Newell tying together these images of both the artwork of that great statue that is both at New Harmony and also in the center of the Iona Abbey by the Jewish artist Lipschitz. But it's a very hard one to say. That's probably why I blocked it out. To his quoting Ellie, it surprised me in the book because it brought together my Celtic interest and background and my Jewish. Because I end up having Sephardic Jewish heritage on one side of my family, the Celtic on the other. He talks about Ellie both serving and as prisoner in the transit camp of Westerbork. And I too have such a story in my own family, and I'd like to tell it to you. My ancestors lived in Holland. They were Sephardic Jew. They had, through their own lineage, escaped from Spain in the 1500s, went to Suriname in South America. Later, went to Holland, split the family, Holland and New York, And actually, the first Sephardic temple in New York City was built by my ancestors, or in part by my ancestors. The family in Holland were swept up in the events of the Holocaust, and all of them perished, except for one surviving great aunt, my great aunt Marie Lyons. All of the family was sent to Sonneberg, which was also originally one of the earliest concentration camps, and then later became a transit camp. My Aunt Marie was a teacher, and it ended up that her co-teacher with her, Cora, offered to hide her in her house rather than her leaving. And of course, none of them knew what really was down the road, and all were living in hope that this was just a bad dream that would soon end, of wearing the yellow markers and being, you know, expelled from doing business in certain areas and all that they went through. So Marie was hid for 2 years in the attic of Cora's house in the middle of Amsterdam. And 6 months of that time, she spent continuously in a chest that was upstairs in the attic, because the house was being searched unexpectedly day and night. They knew that Marie had been listed and that she had gone missing, and they suspected that she was hidden. It ends up there were 5,000 or so Jews in Holland who had been hidden, who did survive, were not found out, which is quite remarkable. When I later heard of these stories, or first began hearing of these stories, I, as a child, and they often arrived at Christmas time when a package would arise from Holland with a big round of Gouda cheese that Marie sent to our family. And then the stories began being told. So I grew up hearing about this amazing story of Marie and Cora. And it wasn't until I was a young teenager that I went and traveled with my mother and actually, for the first time, met Marie. Marie did not leave Holland after the war. She stayed and was very committed to her friends, to Cora, who passed away before I ever went to Holland, and to those who really were helping rebuild after the war. When I finally did meet Marie, sitting in her presence, I was very surprised to find a woman who carried a great calm and peace about her. Because in my child imagination, and what little I knew about the Holocaust, to me it was the most horrible thing I'd ever heard of. It was a nightmare. And I asked her, in those few meetings I had with her, to tell me her story. She, and I think her face, and I think my mother would corroborate this, her face and eyes held the qualities that John describes in the book, of great beauty marked by both deep, deep sorrow and also some calm, something equanimous that was on her brow. And in fact, there were very few wrinkles on her face, which I also was quite struck by. She didn't have the worry lines of my grandmother. When I asked her to tell me what happened to her and her family, she told me clearly, honestly, but in a way that was very striking, because she held no anger or bitterness or animosity towards those who had taken her family and who had the regime that had done these horrible deeds. So I'm going to tell you some of what she said to me. And you have to understand, she lost her entire family, her parents, aunts, uncles, cousins, all removed from their homes, all sent to the death camps. When I asked her how she came to be not full of hatred for the Germans and the Nazis and those Dutch neighbors and fellow countrymen and women who had betrayed so many, she answered this: "Because I have forgiven. I have forgiven them all. I came to see they were no different than me. Simply life circumstances placed us each in different positions around a shared horror. We each did the best we could under the circumstances. Had I been in their shoes, I would have no doubt acted no differently than they." And I couldn't believe, you know, how, well, why was she not bitter? When you come to see we are alike, this human family, you recognize we each share the propensity for great good and for great evil. How can you be bitter when you see that? Bitter towards who? Of course, I will always grieve the loss of my family and friends. I miss them terribly to this day. But when you look into such horror, and if you are brave enough, you see yourself. And when you recognize this self, the self that gets lost through all the experiences and faces of fear and racism and hunger and cruelty and violence and oppression, when you see this self, then you are free. Free to really choose. Free to really forgive. Free to love. I have even forgiven Hitler. What Marie imparted to me at that time marked me deeply in ways that were mostly unconscious. I had a hard time believing her, comprehending, thinking that I could ever come to the same place that she had come to. But yet I still see that moment with her when she told me this as clearly as it was today. The light shining through the window, the chair she was sitting on, where the chair I was sitting on, the platter in front of us that had Dutch biscuits, my mother in the room listening, the whole atmosphere, the pictures on the walls, the smell of the room, I can still feel it. And I know it was one of those soul-marking moments to my life and my journey. Marie was describing what Newell writes about in the book as seeing and healing from both sides of the divide. And what Sardella spoke to you of in terms of the age we are entering of coming into relationship and what that might mean. And of course, Jung, as I mentioned earlier, through his deep, deep work on understanding the process of integration, of that alchemical relationship, of coming into relationship, and of the union of those splits and divides and polarities within us. Another conversation that really affected me many years later was when our family traveled and we were in Nepal and northern India and spent time within numerous Tibetan communities. And there was one encounter with a lama who was the head of his monastery, a very small monastery in Darjeeling, And the survivors of this particular monastery had come from eastern Tibet. And he was one of 10 lamas who survived the destruction of his monastery. He happened to have been out performing a wedding some 10 miles from the monastery the day it was attacked by the Chinese. When he returned, 700 of his fellow lamas had been massacred. 500 women lamas, it was a major training center for women, had been taken into servitude, slavery, pot prostitution primarily, forced into it. And he and the 9 others were the sole survivors. And the devastation for him was not only in the horror of this act, but the fact that so much loss of knowledge happened that day. This was one of the great monasteries in the eastern part of the country that had teachings that had gone back for centuries, scrolls and documents, but mostly the embodied knowledge of many of the high lamas of Tibet. He even said that this monastery, and I believe it was called the Zhang Monastery, was where the art of levitation and what they called the long flying jump was taught, if any of you have ever read about that, which was something he himself was training in. But of course, his master, his teacher, was killed. And he told us many stories as a result of that. And he, along with other lamas, sort of wondered and speculated, because they believe in reincarnation, that many of these who carried this knowledge were incarnating in different parts of the world. They were not coming back as Tibetans. They were entering into places all over the planet. But they had no idea how this knowledge would ever come back. But as he talked again, there was this quality of such peace, of such centeredness, and of no bitterness. Great sorrow, but no bitterness. And then he began to tell us, and I was with my husband and our 2 daughters in this encounter, sitting in his little room drinking yak butter tea. He said, you know, there is no blame we can put on the Chinese, because we have done this to ourselves. The invasion of Tibet was something that we created, we opened up to, through our arrogance, through our hierarchy of seeing ourselves as superior, for our thinking that we had knowledge that no one else had and had to be kept protected and untainted and not shared. When China came to us and asked to form relationship, we closed the doors, we closed the borders. When Westerners came to want to learn, we only gave them cups of tea. We didn't tell them what we knew. And because the Chinese are also us, now, indeed, that knowledge which we carried the walls that held it had to shatter so that it could be released and freed. And it is now free and moving through the world. And I was so struck by this, not only his words, but the depth in which he knew what he was talking about. So this is another example of how, another story of how this balm for all wounds comes from something deep when we see beyond the separation and fragmentation. I had a dream. John Philip talks about dreams a lot in the book, so I thought, hey, I'll share a dream. And this was a very unusual sort of dream. I had been ill and was struggling physically, and I went into a sleep state, and this sleep state dream was so real, it was as if it was really happening. In the night dream vision, whatever you might call it, because I don't know how to categorize it, I woke up and I was in another time. I was in the future. And as I began to be adjusted to the environment I was in, the building and room I was in with other people who I'd never met before, and I began to see the way they were dressed, the unusual architecture of the room, the way the light was being used, some form of technology that I can't quite even articulate. And then what stood out most unusually was everyone was sitting in a circle, except one of the places in the circle was this very, very tall, wide, what looked like a black stone. It had the feeling of slate. And yet, when a person got up from the circle and put their hand on it, it portrayed holographic images. It was also like an extremely advanced computer screen. And while the people were talking and using words and language, they were also using this whatever it was. Do you remember that stone in 2001? Yeah, the monoglyph. Monolith? Yes, monolith. It had elements of that. You know, it had power. For someone to put their hand up, all of their thought structure was made apparent in geometrical patterns and shapes and colors, and sometimes images and pictures. And it was as if that group of people were communicating by being able to see and read each other's thoughts. Their interior life was somehow brought forward and made apparent to everyone. And this group of people were talking about a challenge that they were facing on the earth at that time. And that was when I first heard that I was in the year 2225. And again, very surprised, but I was listening, adjusting, and trying to figure out what I was hearing and why I was there. And one of the people got up and began to put their hand on the tape, on the template, on the stone. And what appeared was this sort of wheel of cosmic wheel of creation. And it sort of could be that you could pick any one of those and come into this incredible, intricate understanding of not only evolution, but incarnation. Anyway, I probably could spend a lifetime trying to research and write a book about that. But I'm not doing that. But what was most interesting about what was said is that in order to understand where we are now, we need to look forward, and we also need to look back. So in this particular moment of our history, with this particular challenge, we need to look back to the year 2000 Western civilization, of which we're 2013 now, and look at what happened when the beginning of the birth of the undivided self began to occur. And it was that, hearing those words in that dream from the future, looking back to this time, the birth of the undivided self. And if we look at the writings that Philip Newell or all of our great thinkers, our systems thinkers, our visionaries, from Teilhard to Jung to all of those who are apprehending the age that we're moving into, what Sardella was talking about, Parker Palmer, his book Towards a Hidden Wholeness, that there is indeed something birthing in our midst. And as best as I could glean, given the gift of this dream experience, was not just the words, but the knowing that this future place held that something incredible happened in our time. The birth of the undivided self. Individual by individual, person by person. Small group by small group, nourishing that in one another. The events of this time when so much destruction is happening on the planet. And ever since that time of that dream, and I woke up, and that then became another marker. What is this birth? How is it happening? Where is it happening? Where are we blocking our understanding of what is taking place inside of us because we're framing it in old modalities of fragmented ways of understanding? And I began to do these retreats. I began to lead retreats and listen to what was happening inside people's lives. What their dreams were, what their visions were, how they were coping with illness, with challenge, with breakdown, and what was emerging. And a lot of those retreats, often I find when I do work with a group of people, it often takes 3 or 4 days of listening for them to begin to even honor, well, yes, I did have this dream way back then, or I did have this knowing. And to begin to pull out, like I said at the beginning, that way of understanding, we are each carriers of part of the story. We are each a part of this emergent birth of whatever, for lack of a better term, from within my own limited psyche, I call the birth of the undivided self, a new harmony. A hope, a collective occurrence that is taking place in the midst of such falling apart and such violence in our world, of such destruction. But something is happening, something is afoot. I'll come back to that because, in a sense, the things I want to share at the second part are practices for the birth of the undivided self, for the new harmony, for the balm, because it's intimately tied together. I want to tell one more story. And what time is it? There's a glare on the clock over there. Okay. Are you all okay here? Good. Another little story. A human being died that night. Have any of you read this book? A Human Being Died That Night. This is a book by Pumla Gobodo-Madikizela. South African. She's someone we need to bring to Santa Barbara. She is the most remarkable woman. She is a psychiatrist, and she was asked to be the chief lead psychiatrist to sit on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission after apartheid fell. As part of the reparation and resolving of what to do, the justice that needed to be agreed upon after the atrocities of apartheid. And this book, to me, is a remarkable, again, uncovering of that bomb and points the direction. And, of course, what they did in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for those who are familiar with it, they, one major part of their work was to bring victims or family of victims in direct relationship with the perpetrator of whether it was a necklacing or an execution, murdering, whatever had happened. And the story grows as she begins to talk about her own process in taking this on with great foreboding to her finally, the most ultimate task was for her to meet in prison with a man who they called Dr. Death, who was the one who the white ruling government, he was the one, but could point, note he, the way it was set up, he was where the buck ended, and no fingers could be pointed to who told him what he needed to do. But he was the one who orchestrated incredible cruelty and atrocities within South Africa. He had military forces, secret guards, all sorts of groups who he basically directed and told them what to do. Anyway, in her discovery of both encountering him and with many of these other people who had been swept up into the perpetrator role of what happened, she found an interesting thing, that they had lost their humanity. That for numerous reasons, they had lost themselves. They had been taken over by, for whether it be fear, threat, desperation, you know, what drives a terrorist to blow himself up? I mean, these are questions we need to really be looking at the other side of, rather than how do I protect myself from this horrible, horrible thing? What causes that? And not only had they lost their humanity, but there was a way to restore it. And the restoration happened when they met the ones they had so hurt. And she describes this process in numerous ways. And it is profoundly moving. And for me, opened my eyes to something I didn't know was possible. You hear of people who go into prisons and work with violent criminals and so on. But this showed me something of a hopefulness of what can happen when two parties affected by an incredible chain of events play out two parts of a situation. And that through their engaging again, and the first signs of that restoration of humanity back to a person who has committed such violence is the feeling of remorse. And she began to understand the power of this feeling, that when remorse was felt, that was what she began to recognize. She knew when that experience happened for an individual that the door had opened for their healing. Anyway, I recommend that book. I won't go into it anymore, but she points through what she's learned to the balm of healing all wounds. F- finally, and just before we end, and then we'll go into... I want to talk about one more thing briefly, and Bob, I guess it's 11 now, isn't it? I want us to reflect when we go and meet with people over the break and so on about how loss of self happens. And loss of self in the way I'm talking about is different than surrender. Different than the process of surrendering to a greater, to circumstances. The loss of self. And I just happened, I was in the middle of writing this talk yesterday, and I got a call from a woman who a friend had recommended to talk to me, who was in the middle of deciding what protocols to use for her cancer. And I've been down that road. I was diagnosed with cancer 4 years ago, and it's been my teacher, one of my big teachers these last few years. But in the conversation with her, what we came to is that ultimately she needed to stay in her own sense of self. Because any of you who've had cancer, you know well, or a major illness, when you go in with that diagnosis, you enter a world where suddenly you lose yourself. The experts are there. The Cancer Association is there. The protocols are there. The statistics. You need to do this. The fear. The immediacy. You've got to act now. You've got, or most likely will die. You're up against all of these collective thought forms, information, moving through doctors who are supposed to know much more than you. And it is very easy to roll over and say, okay, you know better than me. And I have been with so many people now who've gone through this experience. And I went through it myself to a point when I went, oh my God, what has happened? Wait a minute, I'm going to step back and get back in the driver's seat of my relationship to my own body and my relationship to this thing called cancer and to all the information that's coming to me. And luckily, I had a wonderful teacher in having had an aunt, same family as my Aunt Marie, Nina, my Aunt Nina, Aunt Marie was her aunt. Nina was diagnosed when she was a young woman with a very rare form of cancer, right when she had her second daughter and then soon became pregnant with twins. And in fact, those twins are coming to town tomorrow. And Nina, who was given the prognosis of 2 years, lived 40 years, a medical miracle. But what Nina did is she discovered this right away, this loss of self, in the process of the looming forces of encountering collective knowledge. She made a decision that she was going to find a doctor who would not use the word cancer, and who would just simply say, what is my body doing? To tell her, give her information. What is my body doing right now? And let me think about it with my body and with my soul and look at the options of things that might support my body right now. And one of those might be chemo, and one of those might be just sitting by the fireplace crocheting. And it might be going and doing therapy. It might be swimming. It might be doing nothing. But she developed this intuitive sense of knowing within her own self, within her own body wisdom, of what was the right thing to do. And she matched that with the information that was coming from outside. And that's a hard thing to do in the face of of some of the things we have to deal with. And we haven't been taught how to take that stand. Because we mix up surrender, emptying, with loss of self. They're not the same thing. So as we break, and you can come on up, Bob, think about where you might have encountered in your relationships, your life, a loss of self, and when you and how you regain that. And then we'll continue. Thank you.